What's better than one John?
Here's Johnny.
Nobody really knows. That's why we put two of them together. This is Canzano and Wilner,
a.k.a. John and John.
Well, it's spring break in the state of Oregon, and I was on the coast of Washington as all hell was breaking loose across college athletics. And John Wilner is here with me. I'm John Canzano. You can read me at johncanzano.com. John Wilner, you can find him at Pac-12Hotline.com. Wilner, you've been in this position. We were on the Washington coast trying to enjoy a little spring break. I thought, you know, I could get 5-6 hours here or there interrupted? Turns out, no. We have so much to talk about. You've been in that position. What do you do when all hell's breaking loose and you got family vacation?
Hold on. Are Oregonians allowed to vacation on the Washington coast and vice versa?
We are, and especially like it because our spring breaks don't line up. And so we can go to our favorite beach town on the Washington coast, and we're not dealing with a lot of people from Seattle who are getting out of town for spring break as well. But we had a good time, but my phone was blowing up. Pat Chund to the University of Washington. We have Kyle Smith, as expected, leaving Washington State for Stanford. We've got the NCAA tournament. Where do you want to start?
Well, that's you had terrible timing. 2 days, Monday morning, Stanford hires Kyle Smith from Washington. Monday, Washington hires Danny Sprinkle as basketball coach. Monday, the settlement between the Pac-2 and the Pac-10 is finalized. Was it Monday that you got that very interesting item on the CW, or was that Tuesday?
That was. I got wind of it on Monday, wrote it on Tuesday.
Tuesday was also when Pat Chun went, yeah. So it was just over 2 days, a ton of news, and some of it was, I don't know if you'd call it Pac-12 on Pac-12 violence anymore, because this... But former Pac-12 school on current Pac-12 school violence, certainly with Stanford taking a Washington State basketball coach and Washington taking a Washington State athletic director.
Can we start with that?
I
understand the frustration of Washington State fans, and I saw it with Oregon State fans when Jonathan Smith left Oregon State for Michigan State. A lot of Beavers fans saw it as disloyal. They said, you were our guy, you said you were on board with this, and they felt like they had lined up with Oregon State football, and Smith in particular being kind of the underdog guy at the underdog school, and then here he was jumping to the Big Ten Conference. Like, if he had jumped to a rival school, Oregon, it would have set Oregon State fans on fire. And so I understand the frustration they have with Pat Chun. Like, he was on their side in the courtroom up against Honor Marie Casse and University of Washington in that courtroom in Colfax. I was sitting feet away from Chun when, you know, that court case is going on. And, you know, and now suddenly he's jumped sides in this battle. And so I understand that frustration, but I don't know if I blame Pat Chun, because if he's doing what's right for his family and everybody's doing what's right for themselves these days, then isn't that the right move?
Well, I would say they're different to me, because Jonathan Smith is an Oregon State alum. I get that Washington State fans are very frustrated, especially given that they lost their basketball coach and their AD in basically 36 hours, right? But here's what I'd want to know about the Pat Chun situation from Washington State fans. And I'm serious about this. How long is he supposed to stay? Right? He's not an alum. He didn't grow up in Washington, the Pacific Northwest. At what point, how many years do Washington State fans think he should put in? You know, he was there for what, six? Is it 10? Is it 15? Is it 20? At what point do you say, okay, he's put in his time? A little bit similar, Washington fans, some of them were frustrated when Jen Cohen left UW for USC. She'd been there forever. That if you're not an alum, if you're not from, you know, the city, like Chun is from Ohio, I don't understand why the fans are fans forever, but that doesn't mean that the people who work at the schools are going to stay there forever or should stay there forever.
I think some people are looking for allegiance and something to tether themselves to, especially after August of last year. Like, the Oregon State and Washington State contingents were, they were reeling, and they were kind of wandering around trying to grasp for something to hold on to. And I think that from Oregon State's perspective, they initially held on to Jonathan Smith and went, okay, we have him. We've got the stadium. We've got Smith. And from Washington State's standpoint, you know, it wasn't like Jake Dickert until the start of the season really started, you know, they went, started 4-0, and I guess that gave people something to get excited about. But I think a lot of the leadership was Chun, and seeing that this is a really important time with Kirk Schultz as president and Chun, and then Scott Barnes at Oregon State and Giathy Murthy. So I think those fan bases are going, hey, it's one thing to be betrayed by your rival. It's another when someone internally who had fought on your behalf is jumping to the other side. I think, and I get it. I get the frustration with it, but I also am putting myself in Pat Chun's shoes, and I go, if I'm him and that job is offered to you, do you take that job?
You have to, I think. You have to, especially after his dream job, right? I think you could argue that. So Jen Cohen left Washington in August of last year. It was like 3 weeks after the Pac-12 collapse. She goes to USC, right? Washington starts their search. I think there's a good chance they would have hired Pat Chun back then, except he was waiting for his dream job, Ohio State. It's his alma mater, and Ohio State had a vacancy, and that vacancy, you know, that search took a long time all the way through the fall. Then in February, Ohio State doesn't hire Pat Chun, and I think that was just a gut punch for him. They went with Ross Bjork from Texas A&M. So all of a sudden, he's not waiting for Ohio State. And Washington, the job opens again, and he's the logical candidate. He was the logical candidate in October, and he was the logical candidate in March, just that in October, he wasn't interested because he was hoping to get a job at his alma mater. But, you know, I think part of the reason, too, that fans are so upset, Washington, is because he did a good job and he was a great advocate for them. He did a great job fundraising. He hired good coaches. You know, everything that was within his control, which means you have to separate out the collapse of the conference, everything that was within his control about Washington State athletics is in a better spot now than when he took over. And, well, football success, maybe not, but everything else about the university's athletic department is, and that's a lot of it's because of what he's done. And I think that's why fans are frustrated, is because he was doing well at his job, and now they've lost him at this critical time.
Yeah, and I think for Washington fans, they were probably looking for something to grab onto. You had your football coach leave for Alabama, your basketball coach is fired, your AD, who showed up for a blink. Just, you know, couldn't get his family to move to Seattle. They didn't seem interested in that. You got the search firm, by the way, Wilner. Here's an interesting little tidbit. The search firm was really upset with Dannon leaving for Nebraska because, you know, contractually, he has to do 1 year at Washington for them to get paid, or the subsequent search is free. So this second search with Pat Chun that lasted 6 days, Parker Executive Search did it for free because the other search didn't work out. So I was kind of wondering, would they double dip? Apparently they will not.
Well, Parker didn't do a very good job the first time, I would argue. You know, Dannon was not a good fit, and part of that is on the search firm. So we could do a whole show on search firms. I have some very strong opinions there. But the bottom line is Washington in 2 days got a basketball coach and an AD. And I think both of them are good hires. We'll see how Danny Sprinkle does on the court, but he's certainly, you know, he's tied to the school through his dad who played football there, and he did an incredible job at Utah State. And Chun, to me, is a home run hire for Washington. And now it's up to the Cougars. They got to find a basketball coach. They've got to find an athletic director. I think they'll probably do it in that order, the basketball coach first. And they're not doing those in a position of strength, right, because of the situation with the conference.
Let's not let Anna Marie Casse off the hook, though, either, because even though you hire a search firm, if I'm the president, I want to know that the AD is all in, and I need to hear my family's all in. My wife and family are moving here. I don't know that she ever asked that question or ever got that deep. And, you know, some of this is on Dan. And of course, like, you know, you better know when you take that job, whether or not your family's moving. We had a weird case years ago at a newspaper I worked for where a deputy sports editor came onto the scene and did the same thing. His family never left Southern California, and he was kind of working remotely, and everybody was really puzzled as to, is he moving or not? And people were looking his house up on Zillow to see if it was for sale. Like, I'm sure at Washington, some of that was going on, because I heard that Dannon's family was supposed to originally come in November. Then it got pushed to December. Then it got pushed to spring break. Then they were talking summertime. And then all of a sudden he's on the golf course, as we know, and gets the call. And people think, well, I guess he's hiring a basketball coach. Nope, he's out. And so what a weird circumstance for Washington. They end up with Chun. They end up with Sprinkle, who, by the way, was a finalist for the University of Portland job when Portland hired Shante Liggins a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. Sprinkles was a finalist there. So was Jim Shaw, the assistant at Washington State, who I think is going to get that Washington State job in the wake of Kyle Smith. But let's see how it all works out. Can we talk Smith a little bit? I think we both kind of saw this coming. I know that I think he's a great fit for Stanford, but what an emotional introductory news conference, and what a different reaction from Washington State fans who are just sort of giving it the blessing and saying, we wish him well.
Yeah, that is an interesting dichotomy there. I was at the press conference today with Smith, and it was very emotional when he started talking about, you know, his son has autism, and he started talking about how great it will be because of the Stanford's medical, the research, the expertise, everything that they can offer him and his son, their family, to help with that. He got very emotional. And you can't really, you know, I think that is probably part of the reason why Washington State fans are wishing him well. How can you argue, or how can you be upset when a guy's doing it? And that is, you know, a big part of the reason. Now, it's not the only reason. He said Stanford has been his dream job for 30 years. So obviously he's had his eye on the gig for a long time. And Stanford, to their credit, you know, he was the obvious candidate, right? They fired Jared Haase right after Stanford fired their coach right after they lost to Washington State. And at that point, they were basically planning to hire Kyle Smith when that game was unfolding. So, you know, I think he's a really good hire for them after two bad hires with Johnny Dawkins and Jared Haase. I think they finally got it right. And it's nice for Smith, on a personal note, and his family, to have the, you know, everything Stanford has to offer for their son.
It's interesting with Smith because I think he showed a lot of respect for Jared Haase and Stanford in not talking or indicating publicly that he was interested in the Stanford job. But I talked to him last spring and throughout the summer. He brought up his coaching experience at Columbia and said, you know, I understand how to navigate the academic side. And,
yes,
you know, and he thought, you know, gosh, Stanford could really be successful. And so it's interesting to see him get off to a good start, get the team to the NCAA tournament. And then I was at Washington State's last game during the Pac-12 tournament and last win. Stanford, they're playing Stanford, and Haase is about to get fired. And Glenn Sugiyama, who's got the search firm, again, let's start with search firms, walks by me on press row. And I talked to him for a second, and I thought it was interesting that Glenn was in the house. But I asked him, I said, where does Kyle Smith end up? And he says he ends up at a job that's not open yet. Well, guess what happened that evening shortly after that game? You know, Stanford ends up pulling the trigger on Haase, and here comes Kyle Smith into the fold. Like, I literally thought Glenn's probably here to take care of this Stanford search. And by the way, he's got Kyle Smith in the building while he's looking for the next coach.
Yeah, no, he really does fit, you know, the Stanford model. Columbia, he coached at USF, won 20 games 3 years in a row. So he knows the Bay Area, you know, private school. That's big at Stanford, you know, that background. And now he's going to coach him in the ACC. And as with most, if not all, the other football and men's basketball coaching positions in the former Pac-12 schools and the two remaining Pac-12 schools, a lot of success is going to be based on institutional support, right? Getting transfers through the portal, NIL, and are you going to be willing to pay players? Because, you know, in a couple of years, these guys, the athletes are going to be employees, and that's going to really cause a lot of schools to have to think, what are we about? Which side of the line are we on with college sports? And Stanford, I don't know what Stanford's going to do, but all those institutional challenges are things that Kyle Smith's going to have to deal with if he wants to win consistently with Stanford in the ACC.
And clearly, with athletes becoming employees, the when of that, not the if, when that happens, you're going to have a bunch of schools that are going to have to decide what are they in it for. And
yep.
Stanford's got so many of those great Olympic sports. I hate to see that get sacrificed if they go, you know, in one direction or another. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens at that school because it is so different. Where do you want to go next?
Well, let's go to the story you broke, I guess, yesterday morning, right, about the Washington State and Oregon State and their TV deal.
We're talking about a matter of days here before they come out and say, hey, we finalized a deal for our TV rights, and this is for the upcoming football season. Of course, their road games against the Mountain West teams will be on Fox and CBS because those are the Mountain West Conference partners. But, you know, Washington State has 6 home games. Oregon State has 7. The big question I had, and I think we had talked about, was will they bundle those like a normal conference would do? Will the Pac-12 bundle its media rights for its home football games and go out and sell them? Or will Oregon State go on its own and go, hey, look, we got the better schedule. We've got Oregon at home. We've got Purdue at home. We can get a little more money for ours. And then Washington State, you go off on your own. You got Texas Tech and some others. But, you know, the interesting thing that I found out was that, in fact, they are bundling them, Wilner. All 13 are being offered as one. It's possible that the Oregon game or the Texas Tech game could be sold off or broadcast on another network. That's still sort of blooming, but it looks like they're going with the CW, which is interesting. It's a total distribution play. The CW is available in about 99.7% of American households. Wide distribution. I don't know how much money's in this deal. That has not been disclosed, but it looks like, you know, they're not going with a streamer. They're not going with ESPN Plus. They're going with the CW, and it looks to me like CW wants to use the Pac-12 Network's production facility to produce these games. So that's an interesting thing, too, because the CW does not have in-house production. They have NASCAR. They have the ACC. They have LIV Golf. They have all of those entities do their own production. Raycom does the ACC, but NASCAR does its own production. It looks like the Pac-12 Network will be doing the production on those 13 football games.
Well, that, you know, that'll help the, you know, because they've got the lease on for at least another year on the San Ramon facility. So at least they're putting it to good use. And I think that that's a smart move because they are avoiding the clutter of broadcasts that are on ESPN and Fox and CBS. There's so much college football on those networks. And they're on a widely distributed network that's different, but not completely different because the CW has the ACC, like you mentioned. And so they'll be able to cross promote, right? I mean, people watching ACC games, especially watching, you know, Stanford and Cal on CW, they'll be able to cross promote to the Washington State and Oregon State games. So there's some synergy there. And again, they're not going to get lost in that mass of ESPN and Fox broadcast, but they are also not the only entity, college football entity, on CW. So I think it's kind of a sweet spot for them.
Yeah, and as I talked to people in the industry, there was a lot of speculation, like, could they go total streaming and go ESPN Plus? And, you know, could they try to reapproach Apple and or could they come back to Fox? Now, I'm told Fox was interested or may still be interested in that Oregon-Oregon State Civil War game. So it's possible that one still could be pieced out. But if I'm the CW, I want that as part of the 13-game offering. And for Oregon State, Washington State, this is about the ability for anyone in the country to turn on the television on a college football Saturday or whatever and see your games. And, you know, I think we've also heard Kirk Schultz at Washington State talk about kickoff times being important. Well, this will give them some earlier kickoff times than what they're accustomed to. So I think it's a good move for now. I am curious to see how the departure of Pat Chun to Washington might affect the deal, because he was involved. I'm told that it was Chun and it's Scott Barnes at Oregon State who are mainly facilitating this TV part for both schools. And I even reached out to Kirk Schultz at Washington State and started asking him some questions. And his response was, you know, that his athletic director's handling it. And so now, you know, maybe that sort of underscores the importance at Washington State to get somebody in that seat and not lose momentum.
Yeah, well, and they may have, I don't know exactly what role Teresa Gould, the new Pac-12 commissioner, is playing there, but she may have to take a little bit larger role in terms of helping to facilitate. But I think it's a good deal. And, you know, the money thing, right, to me, the question on for their football broadcast, money versus reach, that was a no-brainer. They have got to be relevant. They've got to be seen, even if it means, like, even if those 13 games are only kicking back $2 million a game, right? I think that is secondary to being visible and being, you know, they can't be forgotten, right? They're having enough trouble staying relevant. They can't be, their football broadcast cannot be forgotten. They clearly learned their lesson from the Pac-12 networks.
And I think, like, there's a lot of people looking at what's going on in the ACC and they're going, hey, you know, maybe if the ACC implodes, Stanford and Cal would be available for, you know, a return to the Pac-12, or maybe SMU and Stanford and Cal would all be available. And I don't blame people for hoping that, but hope is not a strategy. Like, you've got to have a strategy. And so this CW thing is strategic. It is a distribution play. It is, you're going to get your games in front of people. Like you said, you're not disappearing. But to go with that, I was disappointed last season that Oregon State and Washington State didn't do more to kind of bang their own drum, us against the world. And, you know, we saw what Kim Mulkey's doing. Now, maybe it's an exaggeration at LSU, but, like, she commanded the attention of everybody who cared about college basketball and LSU and what the Washington Post is doing by sort of seizing the platform. I would like to see a little bit of aggression, a little bit of, alacrity from Washington State and Oregon State, in addition to these games being distributed widely, available all over the country. Like, they need to do a better job of banging the drum and telling their story and staying relevant and visible.
Yep, no doubt. And the other interesting strategic piece is that the Mountain West contract with Fox and CBS only has two more years. So basically, starting with the 2026 season, there's no Mountain West TV deal. And maybe this works for the CW broadcasting these football games. And then maybe, you know, Washington State, Oregon State try to reform the conference, reverse merger with the Mountain West schools. And maybe the CW is interested. And so all of a sudden there's some competition for that football between Fox, CBS, and the CW. That certainly wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for all those schools. You never know what's going to happen, but it is interesting that the CW definitely is kind of dipping its foot into college football and what that could mean for those TV rights in 2 years.
Yeah, and this is close to a deal, but this appears to be the deal. So it looks like it's going to be the CW with maybe a game here or there ending up somewhere else.
Because they don't need the money.
No.
I mean, they need the money, but they don't need the money right now. And we should probably get into that piece too. Another piece of news while you were on vacation, right? The settlement that was initially announced right before Christmas has now been finalized. And there's a I read through it three times to try to figure out some of the legalese, and there's a lot of redactions. But as we kind of figured, and I think as you reported many months ago, right, it's $65 million being withheld total, so $6.5 million withheld from each of the 10 departing schools going into the bank account of the conference for Washington State and Oregon State, and plus they get all future revenue. So even NCAA tournament, this is important for fans to realize, every NCAA tournament unit that Arizona or Oregon or Colorado earned this month, that money is coming, gets paid out next year, and that goes to Washington State and Oregon State. Arizona, Colorado, Oregon, they are not taking their NCAA units with them into their new conferences. So there's a pretty darn good war chest there for those two schools.
Yeah, and, you know, there's other money involved, too. There's Rose Bowl equivalency payments of $50 million a year over the next 2 years. There's college football playoff payouts. But that $65 million is important because that's money that Teresa Gold has said is going to be used to rebuild the conference. Like, that $65 million is going to be set aside. You know, and it's interesting because I was originally told it was really hard to get that number in December. Got it and got somebody to talk about it. But I was originally told that the $6.5 million per school, 10 departing schools, $65 million, that $6.5 million would be paid over 2 years. It looks like now, that was the first thing I went to in this heavily redacted document. You're right. It was like three whole pages were all blacked out at one section. But what I originally immediately went to, how is that money being paid? Because I wanted to know how fast Oregon State and Washington State have the $65 million in their pocket. And it's interesting that they're withholding right now $50 million of that. So $5 million per school will be withheld, and then it's an additional $1.5 million over the next year or whatever. So
By December 31st.
Okay, so they're going to have $50 million of that by July and $65 million by December. So, you know, I'm just spitballing here, Wilner, but if they wanted to start shopping, they could start shopping in July and August if they wanted to.
They could, absolutely. I don't know what the payment cycle is for the Rose Bowl, but they will also have, you know, some money coming in this spring for NCAA tournament units. Right now, the money, so the way the tournament units work is they get paid out over the course of 6 years, and it starts the next year. So the units that are earned now are going to get paid next spring. This spring, all the schools will get the units that were earned last year and previously. And I got to tally up what that is, but you can add that, you know, to the bank account for Washington State and Oregon State as well. So we'll see, but certainly they are going to have some flexibility financially to make some strategic decisions on membership.
For people who are going to ask, the women's NCAA tournament, there's no units involved. There's no additional payments. That deal is included with 39 other NCAA championship events under one contract. Everybody gets an equal share. It's great that the Pac-12 has five teams in the Sweet 16 on the women's side, but that isn't additional money for Oregon State and Washington State. And but I still think everybody could celebrate that.
Oh, for sure. That's a whole... The valuation of the women's tournament, we should do an entire episode on that. It's a very interesting situation. The other piece of that settlement, what you mentioned, the redactions, right? It's page after page of redactions. And one of I think what is the key piece that's redacted is how they're going to handle the liabilities, right? There's a whole bunch of lawsuits against the conference, against the NCAA. And we don't know how the schools decided to deal with that, right? There's this one lawsuit, the House lawsuit. Pac-12 is a named defendant, along with the NCAA and the other power conferences. Damages could be $4 or $5 billion. It's a class action antitrust suit. I mean, let's just say, and I don't know how it's going to work, but, you know, the Pac-12 has hundreds of millions of dollars in damages in that House lawsuit. We don't know how that's getting handled. Are the 10 departing schools, are they legally bound for their one twelfth of the damages for the Pac-12, or would they take the damages that are in the new in their new leagues? That was the piece that I was most interested in, and of course, it is all redacted.
Yeah, and I gotta think that they would share it equally. But what if it's crippling? And what if it's crippling to all conferences? Like, you know, and there's a chance that, you know, like the Big Ten and the SEC, of course, more bulletproof than others. But, you know, I'm thinking about the ACC and how it's wobbling right now. And if you throw that House lawsuit and a substantial judgment on top of everything, it makes it untenable for some of the members. And
it
certainly
does.
The Pac-12 members, even especially the departing members, who are supposed to do with, you know, less than 100% shares in some of their new conferences, I don't know how they make it.
Yeah. So here's what I think is going to happen. It's just a guess. But the conferences are so scared of that lawsuit, and rightfully so, given the potential damages, that all the stuff that's happening now with the Big Ten and the SEC and this movement toward athletes as employees, collective bargaining, sharing in media rights, earning salaries, those, the SEC and the Big Ten especially, want to get those things in place so that they can use it as to basically offset the damages in the House case. So they could go and try to settle the House case and say to the plaintiffs, look, we're making changes A, B, and C to the structure of the NCAA. Athletes are going to get paid, right? They're going to get salaries. So let's not have to pay $5 billion in damages. Maybe we only pay $1 billion in damages. They're trying to change the rules in order to offset getting just bludgeoned in the House case. That's what I think is happening, which is why we are going to have athletes as employees in the next year or two. I mean, it is happening at light speed, and it is going to put a lot of schools in a very difficult spot, because you can easily identify the 30 or 40 that are going to say, we are all in with athletes as employees. And then there's going to be 30 or 40 that are going to say, well, we got to think about this. And then there's going to be some that are like, we're out. We are out. But I think that that's how the whole thing is related to what we're seeing with the rule changes and these lawsuits. That was a long kind of rambling explanation, but it's all interconnected, and they're trying to stave off a situation where there's a settlement for $5 billion.
Yeah, and that sinks the whole ship in the end. I mean,
sinks everything. Even Ohio State's might even feel that.
Yeah, and we talk about, like, we can sit here and we can bellyache about the transfer portal and NIL, and, you know, but that is small potatoes when you compare it to the potential for the whole house to come crumbling down and you know, not exist beyond what we know.
Well, and the interesting thing is, right, Washington State and Oregon State, they're kind of rooting for the house to come tumbling down. They want chaos. Their entire strategy since August 4th and September 1st, when Cal and Stanford left, is to be flexible, right? So that whatever happens with the NCAA, with the ACC, with more realignment, whatever happens, they are flexible enough to take the best option. And they are, I have to think, we didn't even get into the whole Clemson filing the lawsuit against the ACC, but I mean, that was, I'm sure, met with celebrations in Corvallis and Pullman, because they want the ACC to fall apart. That serves their purposes.
Hey, back to your chaos thought. I mean, Scott Barnes at Oregon State, Pat Chun at Washington State, both have said to me in conversations that chaos is their friend. But how much chaos? Like, you know, you don't want the whole thing to come down. You just want it to rattle enough to you know, shake the members up and leave. You know, you want to be in a pinball machine. You know, you don't want a catastrophic earthquake. So,
well, they want to see if the whole thing comes down, and could they get into the Big 12? Could they get into some kind of conference that doesn't exist yet? We know for sure that Oregon State and Washington State would not be part of a 24, 32, 36 team upper tier or Super League or whatever form it takes. But I don't think they care about that, because in that situation, there would be 100 schools just like them. Right now, they're on the outside of the Power Four looking in. But if there's only 32 or 36 teams, then all of a sudden, a lot of these schools that are at a higher level than Washington State and Oregon State now, they're back down on the same tier. And I think that's what they want.
I'm John Canzano. You can read me at johnconzano.com. Get a free subscription or a paid subscription. What works for you works for me. John Wilner, Bay Area News Group. You get him at Pac-12Hotline.com. We have not talked about the tournament other than mentioning the women's tournament. But Wilner, can we just say the Pac-12 showed up to play in the men's tournament and the women's tournament?
Well, certainly in the women's. Yes and no in the men's. So I'm kind of on the fence on this, and you know, you can feel free to disagree, but certainly they showed up to play. But at the same time, there's only one team in the Sweet 16, Arizona, right? And if you're a power conference, that is like the bare minimum. Four teams in the field, one team in the Sweet 16, that is the bare minimum. But the Pac-12 has been so bad in marches past the last couple years that it looks like, wow, what a great tournament. But really, it's not that great a tournament. Arizona is carrying the conference banner once again. I mean, it's very fitting given that it's the last year and Arizona has played such a huge role in Pac-12 basketball since basically 1986 or so. So it's fitting. But, you know, yeah, they played great and Colorado played really well losing and Oregon played really well losing and Jermaine Cousinard was incredible and Washington State won a game. But one team in the Sweet 16, that's it. That's not so great.
I look at the $20 million in the NCAA tournament units, and I say, if I had told you mid-season that they were getting four teams in, and oh, by the way, Oregon's getting into the second round, Washington State's getting into the second round, Arizona's in the second round, you know, Colorado's going to win a couple games. Like, I think you'd take that. Now, they all kind of hit a ceiling at the same time, and it's true, like, I think Oregon is the most disappointing one as I watched the games, because I think Oregon could have beat Creighton and should have been in the Sweet 16, and we might be telling a different story today. But that $20 million in those tournament units, I think, was better than expected. Makes me think Arizona might have a game or two more in them. But I thought, relative to what the expectations were, after seeing, you know, Colorado win and Oregon win, and, you know, I watched that opening round, and I was like, gosh, they started 6-0, and
yeah,
that wasn't too bad.
No, that wasn't. But you're right. It's the expectations. I mean, even on, I go back to the Friday of the Pac-12 tournament. That morning, you could have made the case there were only going to be two teams in the NCAAs on the men's side, Washington State and Arizona. But then it broke just right with Colorado beating Washington State, and that gets Colorado in as a large. Oregon wins it. That gets, so they went from 2-4. So in that regard, it did. It worked out. It was the best case scenario possible. And it's also interesting because that, and I want to get to Arizona real quick, we should, but that morning too was when the college football playoff initially announced the revenue distributions, and Washington State and Oregon State were looking at $360,000 each, a pittance, you know, not even, well, like basically what, 20% of what even a Mountain West school was going to get. And fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, and they got their, Washington State and Oregon State got their shares up to $3.6 million. So in that regard, it was a good couple of days for the Cougars and Beavers.
I got a little bit of backstory on that that is kind of juicy. So I believe that on that Friday, when Oregon State and Washington State were told, hey, you're getting $360,000, that there was a little brushback pitch involved from the SEC and the Big Ten to Kirk Schultz, the Washington State president, for being the guy who was saying, we're not going to vote, I'm not going to sign off on this. Keep in mind, the Pac-12 was a signatory because this is an extension of the original deal. This isn't an all-new deal. So they needed the Pac-12 to sign off on this. But I believe on that Friday, the $360,000, there was also some stipulation built into that $360,000 that would have allowed Oregon State and Washington State to get more if they made the playoff. They would have got a much bigger share. But I think that that was a little bit of a public stay in your lane, know who you are. You're not the Big Ten. You're not the SEC coming from on high. And so by Tuesday, Teresa Gold goes back in there on makes sort of the pitch. Hey, we're not Notre Dame was the quote I got, but we're not exactly UConn either when it comes to football. And so by the time they get back in there, they get a much larger share. Now, I'm told that the negotiations were between Teresa Gold and Tony Petitti, the Big Ten commissioner. Greg Sankey of the SEC had sort of stepped back and let the Big Ten sort of handle, like, how is that going to go down and what are you going to get? Because I think, you know, there may be a little bit of friction there with Kirk Schultz and Greg Sankey.
I was never under the impression that Schultz was a no vote. I thought he just wanted to delay so that he could make a case for Washington State and Oregon State in terms of, you know, their role in the future of the playoff. I don't know.
We both agree. You tell me if I'm wrong. If you have the cards, you got to play them. Like, and I think Kirk Schultz had a duty, not just a, you know, an obligation. He had a duty to play those cards and play it out. But I think it annoyed the others a little bit that, you know, that the Pac-2 didn't just merge with the Mountain West and let them kind of do what they wanted to, the others do what they want to do with major college football. And so I think there was a little bit of a, hey, you know, be careful what you wish for. You might get nothing.
Could be. Certainly the Big Ten and the SEC were driving the whole thing. They were dictating the terms to everybody else, which is what's going to happen in college sports for the, you know, forever at this point, the way those two conferences have consolidated their authority. We should talk about Arizona for a minute too, because only team still playing on the men's side and has just, you know, so fitting, like I said. And I think that they are going to win both games this week. I think they're going to the Final Four. I picked them to go to the Final Four. They're much better equipped, I think, this year with their personnel to get there and to survive the tournament. I don't know if they'll make it to the Monday night championship game, but I think that they will beat Clemson. And Carolina game, the Caleb Love game, since he played for Carolina as recently as last year, the Carolina-Arizona game could be just fantastic. One of the best games of the tournament. I hope that happens. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I've got that one circled. But here's the thing with Arizona. Like, I put him into the Elite Eight on my bracket, but I didn't do it without anxiety because we've all seen them over the years. Like, I do think they'll beat Clemson, but I don't trust them. And I don't trust them because I've seen them and I watched them in the Pac-12 tournament. And I still think, as you know, you watch teams play, people who picked UConn or people who picked Houston or even Purdue are feeling better about those teams than maybe Arizona. But let's see what they do. I mean, you got to give them credit. They're in this position. They're the last Pac-12 team playing. I have them in the Elite Eight, but I'm a little anxious about it, Wilner.
Understandable. The tournament is a time-space continuum. 30 years ago, Arizona made the Final Four. And under similar circumstances as this year, they had lost the year before as a 2 seed to a 15 seed in the first round, Steve Nash and Santa Clara. Then last year, they lose as a 2 seed to a 15 seed in the first round, Princeton. And then the year, 30 years ago, they come back and they kind of blast their way through the West, through LA, into the Final Four. I think we are looking at the exact same scenario playing out this month.
I think Oregon State and Washington State would welcome it.
They would.
They would welcome the $2 million per unit per game.
And Oregon State fans were rooting like hell. They had to have been rooting like hell for Oregon. I mean, I know as much as they hate them, right? Oregon win was $2 million more dollars.
There
for
was
Oregon
a
State.
Weird dynamic going on because I saw some people. I mean, social media is a weird place to get to do market research, but there were some Oregon State fans who were rooting against the Ducks, arguing with Oregon State fans who were rooting for them. There were Oregon fans who were saying, you know, we want to go all the way, but kind of a silver lining that we're out because now we're not playing for Oregon State. Like, it was just some weird stuff that was going on, and I'm glad that that has kind of been put to rest.
I feel like the majority of Pac-12 fans, let me rephrase that. The majority of fans of the 10 departing schools want what's best for Oregon State and Washington State. I mean, there are some that are just trying to kick those schools while they're down. Those people are heartless. But most folks that I have encountered on social media and elsewhere really are rooting for them to succeed and like the fact that the Pac-12 was earning units that will help the Beavers and Cougars in the future. So it's interesting. You can see who's got a heart and who doesn't.
I think there were some people at Washington and Oregon who were tired of being blamed for the downfall of the conference, who were sick of talking about it and who are, eager to punch back. But I think you're right. I think by and large, 95% of people out there are going, it really sucks. It wasn't any fault of Oregon State or Washington State where they ended up. And it could have very well been, Oregon if Phil Knight and Penny Knight had, not supported Oregon the way they did. By the way, I talked to Phil a little bit in Vegas, and it was at the very last Pac-12 men's game, and he was at that Oregon game, and I walked over, and I had a flip card, kind of the Pac-12 tournament roster card, had all the rosters for all the teams in my hand, and I handed it to Penny, and I said, collector's item. And I noticed when she left the arena, it was in her hand still. She was still holding it. And I kind of did it like joking, but, Phil's comment to me was like he was sad about it all ending. And I wanted to be like, well, you could have saved it. Like, you're Shoe Dog. Like, he's the one guy who could have saved it. But, there was some nostalgia going on with he and Penny as they were trying to leave the arena as well.
Yeah, well, he could have saved it. And, we'll see if he goes watches the Ducks play Purdue. In West Lafayette, right? I mean, and there's a lot of folks that are like that, that like him, a lot of nostalgia. It didn't have to happen. That's the thing. It did not have to happen. But I think we've talked to them about that in a few previous episodes over the last year.
We've hit on that. I think, look, I love that we cobbled together this episode. I mean, I think it was important. There's a lot going on. If you are listening, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast. If you're not already subscribed, just reach out, hit that button. You should. It's free. It comes to your phone, comes to your mobile device. You can listen to it, consume it, share it with other people. We just appreciate that you're out here and you're listening, and we'll be back with an all-new episode next week.
Thanks so much, everyone.